Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And, you know, we're all caught up in the society and the world today with various trends, be they food trends, drink trends, accommodation of both trends. We have three to analyze with you and talk about today. The first is a really big one, but the chef author of the book is also an outstanding celebrity in the food world today. It's Alex Stupak, who, as you can tell from the interview, has switched gears on his career a couple of times, and this book is a result of where he is at present. It's called Tacos, and tacos are hot.
And interestingly enough, in the interview, we talked to Alex about what was he contemplating opening new restaurants. He has three already. He mentioned several places around the world that he might be interested. He said the one thing you can be sure of is whatever it is we do, we'll be making tacos.
Alex Stupak, I've been a fan of yours for so long, and from another different guises, from your days as a modernist pastry chef to your Embillon empire. Embillon means push in Spanish. How does that relate to your book? The book, I should mention, is called Tacos. It's delicious, and it is inspirational, I think. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So, Empillon, you're pushing.
Yeah, I mean, it's an unusual meaning for push. It's a different word than empujar. Empujar would be like to push a door open. Empillon means more specifically to push someone or something out of your way.
I see.
And it sounds a little strange to name a restaurant that, but the idea or the deeper meaning behind it for me was to push fear out of your way and push yourself beyond your own boundaries.
Well, you know, you're subtitled this book, Tacos, Recipes and Provocations, and I think that the recipes are delicious and inspiring, and the provocations are hilarious. I mean, I think you start out by saying, let's get it out of the way. I'm a white boy from Massachusetts. So you grew up nowhere near the Mexican border, but you do have a history with Mexico.
I mean, again, I arrived very late to Mexican cuisine. I didn't really start paying attention to it until I was 25 or 26 years old. And even then, it wasn't in my mind that I was going to make it a new direction for my career. It just became slowly over time what I was eating the most of. And because I grew up with no particular ethnic inflection or no one great cuisine, I decided to adopt it as my own.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course, I guess you have nothing on, we just interviewed Diana Kennedy. I mean, she showed up a white young English woman in Mexico and pushed herself into everybody's kitchens.
Yes.
In almost the last century.
Yes, in almost the last century.
In fact, almost two centuries ago,
right.
It seems like.
So I guess the Mexicans are getting used to this sort of thing. A question to start off with is, how did tacos suddenly become the biggest thing in the world?
Well, are they? I didn't know that they are. That's great news for me.
Well, I think they are.
They're definitely the biggest thing in my world, and the reasoning for me is that the taco puts you into everything when it comes to Mexican cooking. It's one small part, and it's certainly not the most important part, but it's the part that most outsiders have their first experience with when it comes to the cuisine. And as outsiders, many have very strong, almost vehement opinions about them, particularly people who live in or grew up in places in America with large Mexican communities. So I use the taco as a portal to begin to start arguments about appropriation authenticity, and really where cuisine is allowed to travel and how it's allowed to grow.
Well, you know, the thing that nobody else could have written this book but you, because of your background and because of your attitude that you're going to push boundaries, you're going to add this whole layer of creativity onto traditionals, and also the way that you handle the technique, emphasizing where the traditional perfect is the only way to do it, but then putting this overlay of all the creative ideas you have.
Right, and the other important point is that I think that when it comes to Mexican cooking, people are overly concerned with tradition. But more importantly, I think people forget that everything that they deem as traditional at one point was radically new. So, again, take something like tacos al pastor as an example. When I began making them professionally, people were very concerned and said, oh, well, are they traditional tacos al pastor? Are they authentic tacos al pastor? And the idea of them came from a Lebanese mashup. So,
yeah, I never understood what the al pastor was. But, I mean, you have a whole restaurant devoted to this kind of taco.
Yeah. Again, my point is that most things that people love and accept as traditional and authentic Mexican cooking at one point were radically new.
Uh-huh. Well,
Mexico didn't always have pork.
The Spanish added all that stuff. I mean, you even said that frying was introduced by the Spaniards.
It is.
That's amazing, yeah.
Again, and that's fine. I mean, every great cuisine has gone through transformation like this. But again, with Mexican cooking, why are so many people who are not Mexican trying to decide what is authentic and what is traditional?
I mean, you have things like fried oyster taco in here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very non-traditional, isn't it? And with
well,
the sauce,
mine is non-traditional, but oysters in a taco is typical. Again, it's like, that's another thing we wanted to change with the book. Again, we're still at a point, disappointingly, when I have menus that have expansive amounts of vegetables and seafood on it, people are like, oh, well, I didn't think of those things as Mexican. And it's like, there's more ocean to land mass ratio in Mexico than there is in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Why is it surprising that crab or lobster or oysters or clams or whatever would end up inside a taco? Why is that surprising? I find it very odd. Too, I mean, unfortunately, most people from my country that travel to Mexico don't really see real Mexico. They go into safe, gated-in resort places.
Right.
Yeah, it's really funny you should say that about seafood, though, because when Ann and Peter were in Mexico City, it was like year 2000, I think, something like that. Ann had a desire for seafood, and our hotel recommended this seafood restaurant. So we went there, but we had to go early because they said this restaurant closes at 8 o'clock in the evening, which is very unusual for something Spanish related. And we discovered in talking to the proprietor when we got there, we said, why do you close at 8 o'clock? And he said, because no one will eat fish after 8 o'clock in Mexico City. If you're eating at the regular dinner time, you eat meat. You don't eat fish. Now, whether you would agree with that or not, I don't know, but that's what they told us. This is the restaurant where they had those movable sinks.
That was the funniest thing.
We were eating raw seafood with our hands, and then having done that, having finished that course, they wheeled over a sink with hot and cold water and everything for us to wash our hands.
Yeah, I thought that was odd. Do you expect people to actually cook from here? I was put off by, I love all the fillings and so on, but the whole thing with nixtamal, I don't know if I'd ever make that.
Right. Then my point is that, I don't know what to tell you. Either a product is fresh, or it's not fresh.
I know.
When we made this book, which you absolutely can cook from, we do not give instructions for reheating tortillas. And for anyone to expect me to do that is unfair. That would be like saying, well, Mario Batali or another famous Italian chef should give instructions on how to reheat refrigerated pasta.
Right.
It's just, I won't do it. We give instructions on how to go to the grocery store and buy something called masa harina and add water to it and make your own tortillas from that. Mm-hmm. But, again, reheating a tortilla is like reheating risotto.
Well, is it easier to do the flour as opposed to the corn?
I think they're both incredibly easy. And again, I'm always surprised that if you actually read the recipe, it's not even a recipe; it's a technique.
Uh-huh. It is. You say that it is a technique. Yep. Yeah. Right. How do you organize this book? I'm looking right now at neo-traditional tortillas, but there's a lot that comes before and after that section.
Well, the book is organized very simply. It's how to make tortillas, how to make salsa, and then how to assemble tacos. There's only three chapters.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, you mentioned repeatedly that Mexican food, to be done well, takes a lot of time. And I actually remember making the mole with chicken it went on forever. doing it right takes forever.
Well, with mole, there's a long cooking process, but at the end of the day, I think it takes more time to gather all the ingredients than anything else.
Uh-huh.
Again, when we did this book, I feel like we simplified things as much as humanly possible. But what we refuse to do is pull punches with what's right, you know? And, my attitude is that if people want to do something incredibly easy, well, then order takeout or go out to a restaurant. But if you want to make it, then you have to make it. And we refuse to give concessions in that way. And not all of our recipes are nearly as complex as mole. And that's why mole was the last thing in our chapter on salsas and sauce work.
Yeah, well, it took a long time, and one of the guests, unfortunately, didn't like chocolate. I did the poblano.
And that's another thing, too, though. There's so very little chocolate in a real mole.
Uh-huh.
There's this misconception to Americans that it's a chocolate sauce.
Uh-huh.
Which it is not.
You carry the whole taco thing way past what anybody thinks of as a taco. What kind of comments are you getting from people? Do you remember who was it who suggested using peas in a guac? And there was an uproar, a national uproar about it. And I'm looking here, you have a mashed pea taco with Parmesan cheese.
Again, vegetables make their way into tacos in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
They simply do.
They're probably not shishito peppers.
No, not shishito peppers, but that's inspired by rajas con crema.
Here's the one I want. Can I come to your restaurant and get sea urchin guac?
Right at this moment, it's not currently on the menu, but it has been in the past.
Yeah. Well, I don't even make any other guacamole besides your pistachio one now. I'm so happy with that.
Thank you.
I have to splurge on the pistachio oil, but I don't mind.
She actually stole the recipe.
She did, of course.
Oh, no, it's not stealing. That's what it's there for. I want people to make it.
Good, because we do.
Yeah, but there's so many unusual things. When I say it's inspiring, if you look at this fava and blood sausage taco with minced salsa verde, it has to get your mind churning as to all the other possibilities for creating new tacos, huh?
Absolutely, I think so.
When I say that tacos have taken over the world, we have a place here that's tacos spelt with a K, and it means octopus in Japanese.
Yes.
Yeah, and the octopus, the grilled octopus taco, is to die for. I dream about it. I think it's unusual to devote a whole restaurant in a small market to tacos, and he's doing it. And what are your favorite recipes here?
Well, they're all my favorite.
They're all your favorite. Bring us up to date about your establishments.
Well, I have three now.
Yes.
I have Empeón, Al Pastor, Taqueria, and Cocina.
Right. And is Cocina still your flagship?
I suppose for now it is. I actually think they're all quite equal, and all three of them do something different.
Yeah. You have a black garlic in here. Do you make your own?
We do sometimes. Sometimes we buy it, though, because it takes so long to actually make.
Oh, yeah, well, I had my fill of black garlic. Somebody sent me a lifetime supply of it.
That's a great gift.
Yeah, well, I have to make it then.
we have a lot of chef friends. They were all the grateful recipients.
Right. Now, what's next down the line? You've carried tacos about as far as you can go, huh?
Right now, there's no immediate plans, but I'm going to keep opening restaurants.
And what, like more taquerias? More Mexican kitchens?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, at this point, if something is going to be called Empeón, there has to be some sort of taco component. It's just part of the brand that
right.
people expect.
Are you ever thinking of moving outside of New York?
Oh, absolutely. I think about it all the time.
Where would you like to go?
Everywhere. I'd like to go to Los Angeles, Mexico City, London, Washington, D.C., Miami, Atlanta, Charleston.
Yeah, Charleston's a fun
Austin.
Dining city.
Yeah, there's so many places I want to go.
Right, but I mean, where would you like to open your next restaurant?
I'm not sure. I would be happy to do any one of those, and there's positives and negatives about staying closer or going farther. What I want isn't really relevant. It's more about what I can actually do, and it all revolves around the team.
The team, okay. So you have the team. Well, and then we have a big house. Would you like to come to our kitchen? We could put a restaurant in the front first floor.
Yeah,
probably.
We have room to put one of those things
yeah.
that will burn your house down.
Well,
I'll try my best to get around to it.
Alex, I'm really thrilled that you've made such a success about this, and I love your food. And the book is, as I said, I think it's going to be an inspiration for people. And you still haven't explained to me how tacos have taken over the world, but every place you look, there's a new take on tacos.
Yeah, I mean, I think people want to eat with their hands, and I think the idea of a morsel of food that you're compelled to eat wrapped up in a tortilla just makes it all that more appealing.
And there's probably never been a civilization that I could think of that didn't have the equivalent of that, a taco.
Sure.
Right. We're familiar with pasties. But anyhow, well, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Could you give us a website?
Our website is empeón.com, EMPELLON. And I hope to see everyone at the restaurant.
Yeah, and I should mention that you actually have dessert tacos in there, too.
Say that again, sorry?
And said you have dessert tacos in there as well.
Do you?
Just a couple, I think, right at the end.
Okay, that's what I thought.
But I enjoyed the black pages.
Oh, thank you.
You have a wicked sense of humor, you know that.
This is Alex on his soapbox. When you open in London, there's a special place where you can sound off. It's called Hyde Park Corner, and anybody can go there, stand on a soapbox, and say anything they like.
Sounds like a dream come true.
You would obviously fit right in. I won't give away any more of your secrets, because listeners, you should buy this book just to read the black pages.
Oh yeah, and I want your food. I crave your food, Alex.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us. And wherever you expand, we will follow. I promise. and we wish you all the very best.
Alex,
thank you so much for having me.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.
Bye.
I always love talking to Alex. He is very uniquely a genius in visualizing new flavor combinations, new exciting combinations of dining, even within a traditional realm such as tacos. Keep going, Alex. I love your food.
Yeah, and on our own menu, incidentally, Anne's been dreaming about avocados, she said recently. So I bought two avocados, and we happen also to have a bottle of Tourangelle
pistachio oil,
and we have some fresh pistachio nuts we just bought. So we're going to make the Alex Stupak avocado recipe, guacamole recipe. That's mentioned in the interview. We're going to do that very soon, and it only has like three ingredients, doesn't it? It has pistachios, pistachio oil, and avocado meat.
Chili, avocados, onions. I mean, it has
basic guacamole,
except you add the pistachio nuts and the pistachio oil.
Try it; you'll be sure to love it. And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Unless you've been living in a cave in the middle of nowhere, I don't know where that would be anymore. You have to have noticed that beer is not a new trend. It's been a long enduring and very, very volatile trend, I would say.
Unfortunately, the current trend is away from Budweiser.
Well, yeah.
And Miller Lite and Miller Genuine Draft and all of those. Apologies for beer. Instead, it's all about artisanal beers, unique flavors.
Craft beers, yeah.
All that kind of good stuff.
And, of course, if you go there, then the next step is you have to be able to figure out what you eat it with the beer.
Yeah, what do you nibble on while you're slaking your thirst with beer of such a wide range of different varieties? So somebody came along and said, well, we can help with that.
Andrea Sloniger is her new book here. She co-authored this book called Beer Bites. And it's really a straightforward, I don't know, would you call it a counseling book on exactly what you can drink with what you eat.
Or you can go the other way around and say, well, what should I eat with what I want to drink? So you got two choices, and a really fascinating effort by people who wanted to contribute something to this world of artisanal beer consumption. If you know where Michael Jackson used to go drink his favorite beer, then you know something about the beer business. Andrea Slonik, I'm not sure whether it was you or your co-author who actually knew this masterpiece of trivia. Do you remember if it was you or him?
It would have been him. He's really the beer expert.
Okay, now we call him the other Michael Jackson, of course, because there's another Michael Jackson. It turns out, sure. and you can tell Christian this, Michael Jackson and Peter Haig were born in the same town in the same year. And didn't meet until about 6 or 7 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And, sweetheart, just in case you're wondering, the recipe is for fish and chips, and the beer, uh-huh. And the beer is a strong ale, a strong bitter ale. What do they call
yes.
it?
Yes.
What are they call it? Batter.
Batter. English bitter ale?
Fish.
Batter.
But we should begin at the beginning, shouldn't we? Because there's a book here that was looking to be written. And the publisher of the book said, I need to find someone to do this book. And they thought of you, and then you needed somebody else who knew a lot more about beer. So you said, Christian is the man who knows.
Di Benedetti. Christian Di Benedetti.
Yes, he is the expert on beer.
And the book is called Beer Bites. And it's, as you can figure out, all about pairing beer with food. And I had a number of questions. I guess we should start, though, with setting parameters. You were not being specifically narrow-minded about the types of beer in this book.
We tried to really present the book as a pairing guide rather than, you know, hard and fast rule that you have to pair this specific brewery's specific beer with this specific dish. We really wanted to look more at the flavor profiles that you find in different styles of beer and match those flavor profiles with the with what you find in the food. So that was our kind of methodology there.
Yeah, and it actually helps you out if you realize that in this case, the beer is the subject of the sentence, not an adjective.
Yes.
Got you. See, notice that skillful play on words.
I don't even understand what you said.
My wife is an English language related person, because she's a long time creative writer and journalist, and I was just trying to explain the difference. I mean, if it's beer bites, then the beer is doing the biting, so the beer must be the subject of the sentence.
I see.
Whereas if it's beer bites, because they have a beer flavor, then beer is an adjective. And I suppose...
Well, that wasn't one of my questions. One of my questions, Andrea, was, did you make up these recipes for the book?
I did, yes.
So
I specifically chose these recipes and developed them from scratch for the particular pairings that we wanted to present.
But many of them have a story associated with them, right? Like the one I just told about the bitter ale fish and chips at the Dove in London. So there's an association, even if they were not exactly cooked there.
That's true. When we set out to write this book, we had three kind of focuses for recipes that we wanted to present. One was that we wanted to kind of pay homage to classic foods that go with beer from the different regions of the world that produce beer, like Germany and Belgium. The second thing was that we wanted to take traditional kind of greasy pub grub that you find in the U.S. at beer bars and beer halls and kind of elevate that or reinvent it or give it a modern twist in some way. And the third idea was just to present completely new ideas in beer and food pairing. And that was kind of a fun thing. We really were taking a look at flavor profiles in the beers that we wanted to focus on, modern trends in cooking and dining, and really wanted to kind of bring beer food into a new era.
Well, now, which came first, or did it vary according to each recipe?
We kind of started, you know, with the seasons, I guess you could say. You know, when we first started working on the book, it was fall, so we really focused on the fall-based ingredients that we wanted to use and the types of beers that you want to drink in the fall. So we did, say, delicata squash that was filled with little bits of bacon and melted Robbiola cheese over it. And that pairs with, you know, a slightly earthier, a little bit larger beer. So that was kind of how we went. And, you know, in the summertime, we wanted to present lighter fare. So we started working on dishes that had, you know, like summery ingredients, like eggplant. We did these little eggplant rolls that go well with a smoked beer, actually. And we did little sardine toast with a shaved fennel pecorino parsley salad that goes really well with saison, which is a clean, crisp beer that really tastes great when it's hot in the summertime.
Did you actually analyze and articulate what goes with means in terms of flavor? I mean, is it feels the same in the mouth as the food, or there's a common flavor profile?
There's two ways that pairings kind of work on your palate. One is that they can complement. So you have a slightly smoky dish, like these grilled eggplant rolls that I talked about. Those go really well with a slightly smoky beer because the flavors kind of match. Same thing goes with, let's say, the they see here. The same thing would go with a kind of a light and crisp, clean food that might pair well with a lager beer. The alternative then would be to kind of contrast flavors, which complements them in another way. It kind of balances the flavor on your palate. So when you look at really hoppy beers, real bitter, big IPAs, you want to present flavors that are going to have some sweetness, some acidity, maybe a little saltiness that kind of counterbalance the bitterness that you find in that beer.
Okay.
So it works really two ways.
Now I relate to an observation that you made in a couple of the different beers that you present, and you said American IPAs, as opposed to English IPAs, we have gone a little bit crazy here in this country in terms of the amount of hops that are included, such that an American IPA can become extraordinarily bitter. So then you need a different strategy of creating a goes with of a different kind, like you just described it.
Yes, that's true.
Well, sometimes it seems to me you want to just startle the readers. Here's one. How about a fruit beer float?
That's actually, you know, that is kind of a surprising idea, but it's also a really fun one.
I'll bet.
It tastes really amazing.
You know? Yeah, I mean, I bet it is. I would never have thought of it, but now that I see it, yeah. I think that would be really fun.
Yeah.
It would be fun to do
some of the beers that have that fruit component as well as sweetness are perfect for dessert, and they taste great with the milky creaminess of ice cream.
Wow.
And I guess the Belgians with their Ambic beers tend to step forward there, right?
Sure, yeah. Lambic beers are perfect for that, the fruit-forward ones.
Well, now, you are a food writer and a recipe editor, but neither one of those terms really explains what you're suddenly doing is writing brand-new recipes. Is this a new turn in your career?
No, actually, this is my focus. Writing cookbooks is definitely the focus.
Up the recipes, composing, I guess, is the term.
Yeah. And creating recipes and editing them really hand in hand, thinking about it from an editor's perspective as well as from the perspective of just creating something really delicious is kind of a win-win situation. So it really is a nice complementary set of positions that I hold.
Wow. Some of these are really off the wall, like green tomato and goat cheese galette.
Yes, that one is kind of a saison, and that's another one that is wonderful in the summer when it's the end of the season, actually more of like an Indian summer time frame. You have green tomatoes still clinging to the vine. You want something to do with them. Their tartness really matches up well with saison. And you have the buttery, flaky crust of the galette. You have the goat cheese, the creaminess of the goat cheese, and it makes for a really wonderful pairing. Cheeses in general go well with saison, especially a goat cheese. So, yeah, that's one of our new, fresh takes on the idea of pairing food with beer.
Yeah, well, you certainly roam the globe, I must say.
Yeah, there's flavor profiles from every different cuisine you could think of, I think. But that's how we like to eat now. We love exploring global flavors.
So the Glamorgan, what were they again? The Glamorgan sausages? You actually made that up.
We didn't make that up. That's actually a very
You didn't make that one up. Okay.
That's a traditional dish of, you know, imitation sausages, really. It's a leek and cheddar croquette.
Yeah, I wanted Anne to hear that because I don't know that she necessarily got to that page. And
those are really delicious. I think, you know, it's kind of like a similar concept as with a Welsh rarebit. You know, they were poor on the farm. They didn't have meat that evening. They decided to make a little sausage out of what they had on hand. So what they had was cheese from their dairy cows and leeks from the garden. So they made a little croquette and called it a sausage.
I didn't get all the way through the book, but is the standard Plowman's Lunch in there?
We do not have that in there.
Well, you're actually perfectly correct to do that. It turns out that when we were talking to Heston Blumenthal of the Fat Duck, he researched foods going back over the centuries, and was disquieted to notice that Plowman's Lunch was created in the 1960s.
Oh yeah,
and was probably really only a way to persuade the patrons to stay longer so they could soak up more beer.
Sure, I love to eat like that, but that's kind of the type of thing we love eating that, but it wasn't something that came to mind when we were coming up with the recipe ideas. You know, we had so many ideas floating out there, and we really had to narrow it down to include the, you know, 65, 75 that we have in the book. So it really, we had to make some cuts, but we think that we delivered a really nice compilation of flavors and styles of food and different cuisines that all match well with beer.
Well, we thought you did too, and it's a really nice story that you and Christian have created together. I can't wait for Beer Bites 2 and Beer Bites 3. I'm sure they're coming somewhere.
Well, we certainly have lots more beers and lots more food to cover.
And Christian, you said he's about to open a new brewery, so
That's a very exciting project. So his family owns a farm out in Newburgh, which is about 40 minutes outside of Portland. It's an old hazelnut farm. And he's converting their beautiful white barn, which is, you know, over 100 years old, into a farmhouse ale brewery. And he'll be using the native yeast to create delicious Belgian-style beers.
Okay, we stayed in Newburgh. There's a huge resort. It's in the wine country, right?
The Allison Hotel.
We stayed there. We stayed there a couple of times, and it's really a great place.
They had outdoor showers.
Yeah.
You're thinking of the place in Yountville, California that had outdoor showers.
Okay, well, after how many years of doing this, I get it all.
It's easy to get them all mixed up. We obviously did, but it sounds like a great place to have a brewery and an
outdoor shower. Why not?
And we wish him well with his venture. And when he's up and running and he can spare a case, have him send it our way. We'd love to sample it.
Absolutely. Or maybe you should stop by the brewery next time you're in town. It's going to be called Wolves and People. Named Wolves and People. It's named after.
Right. I read about that. Wolves and People. I thought that was very unusual.
Yeah, it's named after a game that he and his four brothers used to play on their farm when they were growing up. It was a game of tag. Someone was the wolf, and everyone else was the people. Were the people, so they would hide, and the wolf had to find them.
Well, that's
so that would be a fun
name for a brewery. Well, good luck with your book, Andrea. And
thank you very much.
And
great
good
talking
luck with
to
the
you.
Next one as well.
Thanks a lot.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And now for our final segment, I'll tell you, as often as we've been in Nashville, I didn't realize what an absolutely mad crowd appeal this one dish has. It's called hot chicken. But by the time it filtered down to chain restaurants, I realized that this was something that opened my eyes and my mouth to. So we now have Timothy C. Davis, who wrote an entire cookbook on it, called, of course, the Hot Chicken Cookbook. So how much do you know about hot chicken? Timothy will tell you a lot
more
now. Yeah, a lot more.
It's interesting. We actually did sample some hot chicken when we were at the Music City Food and Wine Festival in Nashville back in last September or October. But we didn't get the story. We did enjoy the hot chicken very much, but we didn't get the story.
It's practically sacred in Nashville.
It is. And if I was the character playing Colonel Sanders in the KFC commercials, I sure wouldn't be going to Nashville anytime soon because they purport to have hot chicken on their menu. We'll lead you to reach your own conclusion having heard what a real expert on hot chicken has to say.
Timothy Charles Davis, that doesn't sound like somebody who's hooked on hot chicken. Maybe you should tell us, first of all, what exactly, if somebody's living in a cave, they may not have heard of it, Nashville's favorite dish, and now quickly extending around the globe even into Asia. Tell us what hot chicken is.
Well, first of all, about the name, I thought Tim Davis sounded too boring, so I just put the whole name in there.
It sounds a bit scholarly, though, right?
It does. It's what my mother calls me when I'm in trouble.
Oh, yeah, right.
I would say that hot chicken is a cayenne-based preparation. Usually includes garlic powder, paprika, most places, I think. It's hard to tell for sure with a lot of places because everybody keeps their recipe secret, but primarily paprika, garlic powder, cayenne, and some sort of fat mixed together, and it's usually applied after the chicken is fried.
Yeah, that was a part I didn't realize until I read your cookbook, which is, of course, the Hot Chicken Cookbook. I didn't realize that the whole thing got cooked first before you slathered this rub on them.
Sometimes people will brine it ahead of time and buttermilk. A popular preparation is buttermilk and hot sauce overnight, and then flour it like you would normally fry it, and then you sort of apply what most people here call a paste afterwards.
Right. It is called a paste, isn't it? Right. Now, there are differing stories about the origins of this item, this hot dish. Do you believe any of them?
I would say that I mostly believe the prince's account. It's no one, at least in my research, has come forward with a verifiable earlier story about it. And from talking to old-timers in Nashville, they remember eating hot chicken at like what was formerly called the Barbecue Chicken Shack, which was the forerunner to Prince's back in the 40s and 50s. So we know that at least it was being served here as early as the 1940s. Their story, while sounding a little fantastic, has not varied very much over the years. So either they have their story down or it's the truth.
I see. So you tend to believe the girlfriend's story.
Well, hold on. We might as well tell the story, right?
Yeah, I was just going to ask him. What is the girlfriend's story? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes, the story is that Thornton Prince was a little bit of a womanizer and that he would go out carousing and come home often late in the morning, 2 or 3 a.m., and that his girlfriend at the time got fed up. And the next morning, like, she would often make him, like, on Sunday morning, chicken for breakfast. And this time she decided to dump the entire spice rack into it. And as a punishment, and the story goes that he really liked it and began playing around with his own sort of preparation of it. And that's what became his first restaurant.
And he opened
It was
Prince.
Called the I believe it was called the Barbecue Chicken Shack.
Okay.
And then that later became Prince's Hot Chicken. His name was Thornton Prince.
Okay. And now Andre is the current owner. And she's not related to the original founder, huh?
No, she is. She is his niece, I believe, his grandniece.
Okay.
She took it over, I believe, in 1980 or 81. And she's been in the current location, I believe, since 1987.
I see. Huh. Now, you fill a whole book with this by doing what? You extend your coverage of recipes to include sides, accompaniments. I mean, it's de rigueur that it has to come on white bread with pickles, right?
That's typically the way it's served. The white bread serves to kind of soak up all the paste or the grease, basically, if I'm being honest. And the pickles are to kind of like just give your mouth something else to hopefully kind of cut down the burn a little bit. But most people think they don't really add anything. At this point, it's just tradition.
I see. And I mean, they don't have to be fried, these pickles?
No, they're usually just even like the white bread is like the cheapest white bread you can find. And the pickles are probably Mount Olive or, you know, like a, just an ordinary grocery store pickle slice.
Now, it has become something of a cult.
It has, and it's starting to become, I guess in the last 10 years or so, with Hattie B's opening and Pepper Fire opening, both of which now definitely have their acolytes. It became a bigger thing in the last 10 years, and my theory is that as Nashville has sort of taken off in the popular media and as it's grown so much in the last 10 years, I think some of the attention focused on Nashville, too, has probably helped.
Right. There are lots of restaurateurs and chefs opening establishments in Nashville. And I guess it's a rite of passage to get your fill of hot chicken, right?
But here's the important question. Has it become a cult outside of Nashville? So have you transplanted this to other culinary capitals?
We have actually, I was talking about this with the publisher the other day. We, at the end of the book, put a listing of hot chicken restaurants in other cities.
Yeah, it
included New York, L.A., Houston, Dallas, all sorts of places. And actually, since the book has come out there, we probably could have added 10 more places. They're just dedicated hot chicken restaurants. There are places in Australia, even.
So it's really happening. It's really happening for hot chicken.
It's really taking off, yeah. I don't have much occasion to get to Australia, but I would love to try it. But the person there, Morgan McLone in Australia, is a place called Bell's Hot Chicken, and he used to work at Husk here in Nashville. So
really,
yeah. So I believe he probably is keeping it pretty true to the old ways, I would imagine.
Is he in Melbourne?
I believe it is in Melbourne, and they are opening another place, too. I don't know if they're opening one in Sydney, but I know he was opening a second place because it's just evidently they still have, like, lines at the door.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, it's a very Southern thing. You're active in the Southern Foodways.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've done a fair amount of work with them over the years. I helped co-write the Southern Foodways Alliance Community Cookbook a few years back.
And now you can also get degrees of hotness, right?
You can get anywhere. Most places offer, these days, they will offer a plain hot chicken, most places, and then a mild, medium, hot, and then they have various names for it, but like an extra hot, like Hattie B's, for instance, is Shut the Clock Up.
Shut the Clock Up. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
You really did a book about the culture surrounding this phenomenon, right?
That's part of what I wanted to sort of show, is that, like, more so than being, like, a trendy food, that it, especially among people in Nashville, there's a culture of it going back a number of years. There's a hot chicken festival here every year.
Oh, yeah, tell us about that.
It was started by a former mayor named Bill Purcell, who's
a big fan of hot chicken.
He used to, he would hold meetings with people that he was going to, you know, meet for whatever reason at Prince's Hot Chicken, and was the first one to sort of, like, take the local story, and, like, he got it in some, like, the airline magazines, and he would introduce it to, like, not heads of state, but, you know, people from other cities that would visit, he would take them there, and so they would bring that story back to wherever they were from. And Andre Prince Jeffries at Prince's at least gives him, I think she said, like, you know, at least half the credit for hot chicken sort of taking off.
How about if you could tell us your 10 commandments of hot chicken?
I do not have it right in front of me. One of them that I think was referred to two or three times is don't touch your eyes for any reason whatsoever.
Exactly. And I thought that one got my attention right away.
That's hours later, some people would say even after washing your hands, wash your hands the second time. Because it's more or less getting in your eyes is something akin to pepper spray.
It says this goeth doubly for touching other sensitive areas on yourself or others.
Exactly. I was trying to find a safe way to say that.
No, I can see you on the Tonight Show yet.
I did find the Ten Commandments of Hot Chicken, if you would like me to.
Go ahead.
Aren't they funny?
Go ahead and then answer one more question, and then you've got to go off and get a fix. I am interested in, after the Ten Commandments, I am interested in what you drink with hot chicken. So.
Okay.
So if you're wondering what's coming next, you'll know.
Number one is the thou shalt not touch thy eyes with thy fingers after eating hot chicken. Number two, thou shalt know that this goeth doubly for touching other sensitive areas on yourself or others. Thou shalt wear rubber gloves when preparing hot chicken in a home setting. When mixing the spices, consider wearing a mask like you've seen on The Doctors or Michael Jackson to avoid the inevitable violent cayenne dust sneezing fit. Practice the patience of Job, which is to say thou shalt not be in any sort of hurry as regards any aspect of hot chicken. It was slow food before slow food was cool. Number six, seriously, don't touch your eyes, even if you just use the wet wipe. Number seven, do not order the extra hot anywhere, least of all at the Iconic Prince's. Number eight, do not expect any hot chicken accoutrements, white bread, pickles, sides, or drinks to in any way lessen pain. You don't set out to eat hot chicken not expecting or craving the heat. Number nine, do not visit Nashville, eat real hot chicken, and then start a restaurant serving a toned-down, tepid version in hopes of bringing hot chicken to the masses. And number 10 is lather, rinse, and repeat.
Very good.
Okay. Then, okay. Yeah. So what do you drink? What do you drink with hot chicken?
I haven't found anything that really works. I drink water personally. Somebody had told me carbonated beverages provide you like the bubbling on your tongue provides a little relief, but I found nothing. There are some people that swear by milk, but none of these places serve milk.
Yeah, milk is often prescribed for super hot Asian food. I know.
They
don't drink milk in Asia.
When I go into eating hot chicken, I usually think that I know my mouth is going to be burning, and so water to kind of like quench your thirst a little bit. But I literally have not found anything that like really. Tones it down much.
Yeah, well, here's one to try, incidentally. We tried this just a couple of weeks ago at a Zhechuan restaurant where they served something akin to hot chicken, except it was beef in a hot pot. And that's an off-dry white wine.
Oh, yeah.
One with a little bit of sparkle even's okay. So if you want to try that, you can try that. That's what we found that the table agreed that worked well.
That's interesting. I think you would have a hard time in some of the more old school joints around Nashville. At least you'd probably get a few snickers if you had white wine.
Right.
Well, it's always risky. There's always an 11th or 12th commandment.
There aren't. Two of the places, Hattie B's and Pepper Fire, now serve beer, and I have not tried that pairing. I don't really drink anymore, but I've heard that beer can help. And
yeah, beer's another one too. Beer also works.
And I wonder with the beer sometimes is that maybe the beer takes your mind off of the hot food a little bit.
You know, I see this photo of we interviewed Andrew Zimmern at this the Music City Food and Wine Festival this year, actually. This is a dumb question, maybe, but I'm just curious. What motivated you to write this book, and what was your mission in doing so?
The motivation was I used to meet the publisher. He used to be an editor at Oxford American, and we would meet and sort of have lunch like once a week at a bunch of different places. And we had hot chicken one time, and we had talked about, like, that there was information out there about hot chicken, but it was just little dribs and drabs on the internet and little mentions and books and stuff. And we literally sort of said to each other, someone should write a book on hot chicken one day. And I believe that we texted each other the same night with the same thing, like, well, why don't we try it? and the goal, I mean, the initial goal was to have all the history in one place and be sort of like the first long-form kind of look at the dish, and the secondary reason was to have all the information that we could find that we knew about, and it was verifiable all in one place. So people that were looking to study hot chicken in the future, or, if people were interested about it, someone could just point out this one book, like, hey, this has everything you can think of regarding this one food. And so we were wondering initially, too. Initially, the book was going to be more around 160 pages.
Well, listeners, this may be your most reliable source as well for hot pig ears. And I kid you not. Well, good luck with your book, Timothy Charles Davis.
Thank you.
And enjoy your hot chicken and don't put in your... Anyhow, this is just about everything you need to know about the hot chicken dish.
Hopefully. There's been a lot of developments even since it came out in early October. With KFC is coming out with a version.
Oh, I saw that. That was a joke.
Oh, my God. What an awful thought that is.
Yeah. I read that, too. Yeah.
As a friend of mine mentioned to me, though, like, you know, McDonald's sells lots of hamburgers, but there are still plenty of places you can go to get a great hamburger.
Right. Well, Timothy, thank you so much.
So there you have it. That ended today's program. You now know a lot more than you ever knew about tacos. You know what to drink with your beer, and you know about an exciting new food group called Hot Chicken. Nothing if not informative here at On the Menu Radio. Sweetheart, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.